You're listening to On the Record Online with Eric Schwartzman, where reporters and journalists go on the record about how they use the internet to cover the news. For the latest trends, tips, and tactics on how the web shapes popular opinion, subscribe to our RSS news feed or visit us online at www.ipressroom.com.
John Markoff, technology reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer, goes on the record online.
You know, I think that we're moving toward a point where we get to that million-channel world by just hooking together BitTorrent and RSS feeds. I mean, I think that's the future of television. You know, I see that coming very, very quickly.
We'll be back. Stay with us.
Don't be left behind. Get the latest online PR tools and services from iPressroom. Powerful, easy to use, available on demand. Extend your sphere of influence online with iPressroom. Tools for online media centers, virtual private press rooms, RSS news feeds, podcasts, and more at www.ipressroom.com. iPressroom, always on, even when you're off.
John Markoff has been writing about technology since 1977. He's written for InfoWorld, Byte Magazine, the San Francisco Examiner, the San Francisco Mercury News, and is currently a reporter with the New York Times Business Section, where he covers Silicon Valley, computers, and technology. Since joining the New York Times in 1988, he broke the story identifying the author of the 1988 Internet worm that crashed thousands of computers and the Clinton administration's clipper chip surveillance plans. I am pleased to have him with me on this podcast.
Hi.
So I wanted to ask you first, since you are operating in Silicon Valley and coordinating daily with the business staff, business editorial staff in New York, how do you coordinate your efforts with them on a daily basis?
Well, I'm 3,000 miles away, so I use the telephone and I use electronic mail. We really don't go much beyond that. With a number of reporters and some editors at the paper, I use instant messaging, but not in a structured way. So, the Times is heavily email-driven and heavily telephone-driven.
So there are no regular editorial meetings that you dial into via conference call daily?
That comes and goes. It depends on the editor. We have, over the years, had weekly technology meetings, but that's one of the blessings of being a reporter. I don't do a lot of meetings, at least not New York Times meetings. I think people who are in New York have to do more of that. I spent 4 years in New York, and meetings are more of a regular event than they are now.
So tell us a little bit about the vetting process. You have an idea for a new story that you want to write for the paper. Tell me the mechanism and the hierarchy behind the decision-making process of how a story actually winds up in the paper.
Well, I guess it depends on the story. Let me give you a recent example. On Monday evening, Jack Kilby, the inventor of the integrated circuit, died at age 81, and at about 1 o'clock the next afternoon, the obituary editor, one of the obituary editors, called me and asked me if I could write the story. And she had asked another technology writer in New York who was busy doing something else, and I tend to enjoy doing obituaries of people who've been involved in the computer industry, and so I did it. So that was a very simple example. There wasn't a lot of overhead. I turned the story around in about 3 hours, and it went in the paper. You can go to the opposite end of the spectrum. There are projects, there are feature stories, and in that case, occasionally they're editor-driven, but the Times is still a fairly bottoms-up organization. I mean, most of my ideas, most of the things you see in the paper under my byline are in particular, if they're features or exclusives, are things that I sort of stumbled across on my own. There are projects, and occasionally I participate in projects, or I'll chip in and help other reporters, but it's pretty ad hoc. And on occasion, I write for other sections as well when I have ideas.
So, for example, let's say you have a specific feature that you'd like to write, and let's say perhaps it is an exclusive. Who do you call? Who do you talk to at the Times?
Well, I'm responsible. The way that the Times organizes its technology coverage now, for the business section, there is a technology editor. His name is Kevin McKenna. He was the circuits editor of the paper and took over this job over a couple of months ago. And Kevin's my manager, and so he's my first stop on anything. For daily spot news, occasionally I'll go to Terry Tang, who's the deputy technology editor.
I'm sorry.
But most of my content.
The last name clipped.
Her name is Terry Tang,
okay.
T-A-N-G, mm-hmm. And she's the deputy technology editor. They're both in the business section, and they both right now report to the business editor of the paper, whose name is Larry Ingracia. But I'll go to Kevin first on almost all of my sort of news ideas, whether they're enterprise stories or whether they're daily stories.
And they both report to the same editor?
I think Terry reports to Kevin, and Kevin reports to Larry Ingracia, who's the paper's business editor.
Now, there are so many different daily issues of the New York Times. There's the international edition, there's the national edition, there's the metro edition. How are the decisions made behind what stories will appear in which issues?
A little bit of that's opaque to me. I mean, I think that the only time where that has an effect on what I do, I mean, from the West Coast, I try to file by, 3:30 at the latest, 4 o'clock West Coast time. However, occasionally they will ask me to file something for the web if it seems to be a competitive story. Or if the International Herald Tribune, which is now owned by the New York Times, is interested in the story, they will ask me to file something early, which I think typically I have to file between noon and 1 o'clock for the IHT.
And does the International Herald Tribune get wind of the fact that you have a story that you're working on that they might be interested in?
Well, we have an editing system, which, actually I don't live in the editing system. There is an editing system which has schedules, and those schedules can be seen inside the Times organization. And the editors at the IHT will see the stories on the schedule, or they'll see a wire, they'll see a wire announcement, and they'll know that I'm working on it, and they'll ask for it.
Now, what about the syndicate? Obviously, the New York Times syndicate sends out a lot of news that is picked up by other daily and weekly and monthly print publications. How are those decisions made? I mean, what makes a story worthy of syndication?
I think almost everything. Well, I don't know what doesn't go on the syndicate, but I think almost everything, I'm sure that everything I write is syndicated. And I had thought that
At this point in the interview, my hot recorder and Skype software crashed. It locked up and it crashed, and I was disconnected because I had been doing the interview via Skype out and recording with hot recorder. And I rebooted my computer, and I called John back, and I recorded the second half of the interview separately. And after I had completed the interview and played back the file, I learned that it had recorded his answers, but not my questions. So what I did was I went through the interview and have done the best I can to recreate the questions I asked that stimulated the answers he delivered. Now, I'm doing this in retrospect. I had my notes in front of me, and these interviews aren't entirely scripted. I do my research. I get involved in the conversation. Then if things pop into my mind that I think would be of interest to other people in the PR industry, I go ahead and interject those questions. And if they're questions that may not even be related to PR, but that I think the particular journalist is an expert on based on their area of coverage, I'll introduce those questions as well. So I've done my best in retrospect to recreate the questions and edit them in for this portion of the podcast. But it's entirely possible that some of these questions may not be exactly what were asked. I mean, as a matter of fact, I'm sure they're probably not the questions that I did ask. But having said that, being too chicken to call up John Markoff and ask him to re-record the second half of the interview, I've done my best to just edit it together here on the podcast. On with the show. The next question, how has the internet changed the way you cover technology in the Valley?
I'm affected by the array of internet publications, from CNET to things like Engadget and Gizmodo and a million bloggers. So the world has really changed. The internet has changed the process and of covering Silicon Valley.
How has technology changed the way you communicate?
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. In a way, I've gone the whole cycle. There was a period when I used electronic mail as an advantage because most reporters didn't use electronic mail. And that was nice. And now everybody uses electronic mail, and everybody uses the Internet, and so it's no longer a competitive advantage. I've gone back to talking to people, by telephone and by face-to-face, doing it the old-fashioned way. And you still get the best stuff that way. And, I use a fair amount of technology. I certainly look at all of the Internet sources I can. And, I have been keeping a contact list since when did I start? I started in the early 80s, keeping it electronically, and I have a Rolodex of about 5,000 names that I've built up, laboriously, and it's probably 10 or 20% inaccurate, but it's still invaluable. As a matter of fact, the current fad on the internet is this thing called tagging, and I started tagging my contacts. I was just ahead of the curve on tagging, so at least in one way, I'm very hip. But in writing, I use outliners and word processors. That's sort of the standard, standard tools of any writer.
How are you able to deal with spam? Have you found any filtering technology that actually works?
I'll tell you, I think it all is terrible. I think filters, as they exist, are not agents. Somebody built a good agent, which is an intelligent filter. I'd love to see it. Everybody's been talking about it forever. I think it's remarkable that nobody's done a good job. Everything I've seen is flawed. And I have as bad a spam problem as anybody. And, nothing I've seen, has come anywhere near to fixing email. One thing that's interesting, from a public relations point of view is that there was a period before the rise of the web when, I got tubs of mail. And, now there are no dead trees. I get almost no mail, and I get a vast, stream of bits. And, it's impossible for me to deal with it. And, the Times has finally installed a spam filter, which, of course, has false positives, and so I have to look at it. And that's one of the most miserable tasks in my life. And I run my own spam filter. It has false positives, so I have to look at it. And, I'm in this weird, weird position where it's hard to tell the difference between, between real spam and, just people who are trying to get my attention, who I want to get my attention. So believe me, I'd love to see a good filter, but I haven't seen one.
What blogs and RSS feeds do you monitor to keep informed about technology developments?
I read an array of things, and it's hard to say that I find any one of them most valuable. I mean, it sort of depends on what you're looking for. I mean, there's a guy, for example, it goes all the way on one end from these individuals who follow the world from certain points of view. Am Malik, who's a writer at Business 2.0 and has his own blog on telecommunications, is an interesting example. On one end of the spectrum, I would follow Dan Gilmore. I read Good Morning Silicon Valley, which is now in an RSS form. I have an RSS aggregator that has probably 70 RSS feeds that I'm following now, and I continue to throw things out of it. What else? I mean, you know, traditionally, I'm a big fan of EE Times for following sort of hardcore technology in the Valley. I think the world is far too internet-centric. I mean, I think there's a technology story that's interesting that's not about the internet. And, you know, I think that world is undercovered as a result of the rise of the internet.
What RSS reader do you use?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, a caveat, I live in the Mac world. Because life is too short for viruses and spam. And as a result, at the moment I'm using something that is nice in the Mac world, which is called NetNews Wire Lite, i.e. it's the free version. And, you know, I think I played around with two or three of them in the Mac world and settled on this one because it was stable and, you know, efficient. It was, made it very quick to get through things. That said, I'm not a big fan of RSS aggregators. You know, I'd go back to the San Francisco Examiner in the 1980s where there was a guy in our newsroom who I thought had the worst job in the newsroom. He was called the wire editor, and he would follow the wires, and you know, when there was something important, he would let you know about it. And now, in my mind, RSS aggregators have just turned us all into wire editors, which, you know, I don't really think has improved the quality of anybody's life, and that has not necessarily increased their insight or their knowledge either. But, you know, so I think there's, not that I'm a Luddite, I just think that there's definitely another level of technology, that's sort of post-filter that we have to find.
How did the NASDAQ meltdown in 2000 change the way reporters qualify stories today about the next big thing?
You know, I hate to say it, but I don't think it has changed anything. I think we're in the midst of a second bubble right now, and we've forgotten the past, and all the great sins are being repeated. You know, not quite to the extent of the frenzy of 1999 and 2000, but I see a lot of the same things going on. You know, there's a rush to money. There's a rush to rapid growth. You know, I think that for a while, the major news outlets felt somewhat chastised and were shying away from covering this stuff at all. But everybody's, you know, Google approaches, is it 300 or is it 200? But Google approaches 300, and everybody's obsessed with it. You know, what's different about this picture than 5 years ago? I don't think very much. And I think there are fewer outlets now. I mean, there was a pruning effect, but I don't think that any lessons were learned at all, to be very honest.
Why is there such a herd mentality in business journalism?
Well, where I find fault is that the media seems to be, you know, following the money, not necessarily in a good way, but it's the business section equivalent of celebrity journalism. We care more about money and power than we do about ideas. And News at 11, that's perhaps no surprise, but that's what I think drives the editors of magazines and newspapers in America. And that, you know, what we get is this sort of white hot focus on stock market opportunities, as opposed to, you know, perhaps sort of more thoughtful coverage or coverage, my own interests are technology for technology in itself. And, you know, I felt a little bit pushed to the sideline in the last bubble because it wasn't a technology story. It was a business story. It was a great business story, but I don't really see myself as a business reporter.
Is the media partly to blame for all the hype that led to the bursting of the NASDAQ bubble?
No, I wouldn't blame the media. I think it was greed. And I don't think the media is responsible for the greed. I think the media was serving the interest of its readership, which was, where can I make a quick buck? And I don't want to be left out of this. And we were pandering to that, perhaps. But I think the driving force was just the greed of a public that thought there was an opportunity to get rich quick.
Why do some media outlets act as influencers? Why do we see the national news coverage agenda being set by outlets like the New York Times? Who are the influencers?
Well, I don't know if it's a stray, but I definitely agree with you that there's a herd mentality. And, I've noticed that over the years. There are influential media centers. The New York Times certainly is one. I don't know why that has happened, but I certainly notice its effects. And, you know, even within the New York Times, where a story plays in the newspaper has a direct, you know, connection to the power and influence of the story, which really is a you know, a statement about the continued influence of sort of old media traditions. I'm not even talking about what plays on the front of the web section. I'm talking about what plays on the front of the traditional paper.
What are the new technologies you see as potentially most disruptive to the current media ecosystem?
Well, I have to sort of point to the latest wave of internet software, the stuff that's emerging out of the peer-to-peer world, based on top of well, things like examples are Flickr and Delicious, just as examples, not as threats to the traditional media, but I think the threats will be based on systems that emerge that use similar technologies, peer-to-peer architecture with an open API that allows people to reuse the information in ways never thought of by the people who created the content. I mean, there's an amazing range of you know, Wikipedia-style architectures out there affecting all kinds of digital information, and they're all having an impact on the traditional media. If only just to steal attention. I mean, where is people's attention focused? And now there are many alternatives.
For those of our listeners who don't know, what is an API?
Application Programmers Interface, which refers to a set of, think of them as hooks or instructions that a programmer can use to persuade the underlying system to do something. In a operating system, the API will allow you to do things like get a file from the disk, and the programmer will use that, and then when you pop up that menu to look for the file, you know, under the hood, it's the API that's causing that to happen.
How far off, in your estimation, is ubiquitous wireless broadband?
Well, I think that it will probably be within a half a decade. I mean, you already see, my test for these things is to walk into Best Buy or Fry's and look at floor space. And, you know, wireless routers are a huge section in those stores already with a million consumer alternatives. And so my guess is it's probably at somewhere between 10 and 20% of broadband users now. So that's still a pretty small sliver, but I bet you the rate of Wi-Fi is going up dramatically. And then, of course, the carriers, the cellular telephone carriers, are looking to deploy their own form of wireless broadband. And then there are other players. There are lots of other players who are looking for things. So, you know, I think certainly before 2010 or around 2010, we'll be more than 50% have wireless broadband access. I think that's a really, you know, in your terms, one of those tipping points, because it's a chicken and egg kind of situation. And I think when you have that kind of broadband access accessible to a significant part of the population, that you'll get one of these sort of transformations, which is why I think that, you know, that sort of the futility, I think you were also talking about sort of the speculation on the future by the media and the so-called visionaries in Silicon Valley. I mean, I think everybody's always wrong because things change so quickly that it's very difficult to predict particular outcomes.
What do you think about IPTV?
Well, you know, are you using the term in the generic sense or the Microsoft, you know, trademark sense? Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that we're moving to a point where we'll get to that million-channel world by just hooking together BitTorrent and RSS feeds. I mean, I think that's the future of television. You know, I see that coming very, very quickly. You know, right now it's a hobbyist phenomenon with Myth TV and things like that. And, you know, but the media center stuff is there. I think Microsoft tomorrow is going to announce, you know, that they're building RSS functionality into Longhorn, which means it shows up for everybody at the end of 2006. But, you know, I think that things will be trickle-fed in, and will the TiVo model will be the right model, and, you know, we'll select things and they'll show up, and we'll watch them on our HDTV plasma screens. That seems inevitable to me. I mean, once again, walk into Circuit City or Best Buy and look at how they allocate the floor space. I mean, it's all big screens. You know, half of these stores now, and that's all been within the last 3 years. The floor space arrangement has changed dramatically.
John Markoff is a technology reporter with the New York Times. His new book, What the Dormouse Said, How the 60s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer, is currently on sale. At this point, I thanked him for participating in the podcast, and he said,
thanks very much.
You've been listening to On the Record Online with Eric Schwartzman, where reporters and journalists go on the record about how they use the web to cover the news. For the latest trends, tips, and tactics on how the web impacts corporate reputations, subscribe to our RSS news feed or visit us online at www.ipressroom.com.